In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
South Dakota scientists on the forefront of research and response. From SDPB, this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we crisscross the state searching for some of the year's most compelling science stories. First up, what does Hollywood get right about tornado science? We revisit a conversation with Todd Heitkamp at the National Weather Service about the faulty science of natural disaster movies. Christopher Anderson from the University of South Dakota invites us into his chameleon lab. We'll learn about the evolutionary marvel and why Vermilion is a hub for its research. Plus, paleontologist Madison Schriro takes us back to the prehistoric Great Plains. She shares her research into an extinct deer and why its tiny fossil is reshaping a branch of the Tree of Life. It's a South Dakota Science Roundup. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Filmgoers can't seem to get enough of tornado movies. Twisters touched down in theaters for the latest pop culture fix. The new movie is a sequel to the 1996 thriller Twister. To understand the science of extreme weather and to encourage safety in South Dakota, we talked with National Weather Service meteorologist in charge, Todd Heitkamp. Let's start with what he had to say about the original movie, what it got right, and what it got very, very wrong.
Well, I can easily state that or answer that question with one brief statement. What they got, the only thing they got right is that, yes, we do have tornadoes, and yes, we have tornado chasers. That's about it.
That's it. Period.
Yeah, I mean, they're, obviously, when anytime Hollywood gets a hold of something like that, they're going to make it a little bit more extravagant or a little bit more Hollywoodish, if you know what I mean. And that's what the case was here with tornadoes, with Twister. And so, the thing about it is that there's been a lot of changes since that movie came out in 96. I mean, I came here in Sioux Falls in 94, and I've seen a lot of people change their behavior because of that tornado, because of the fact that they had childhood memories, like you said, Lori. I mean, before this movie Twister came out, really all of us that were tornado enthusiasts or had a movie that talked about tornadoes, you have to go back to The Wizard of Oz, and even that was just a brief segment in that movie.
Mm. All right. So what are some of the things that have changed in tornado science? Because one of the things that endures is this idea that we want to be able to predict them, disrupt their path, do something to somehow mitigate the damage. What are scientists trying to do to understand tornadoes?
Well, I think the main thing is to understand. We have a much better understanding of how tornadoes developed since 1996. We can issue those warnings out, especially for these larger tornadoes that are responsible for the majority of the damage that we have seen this spring, such as Greenfield, Iowa, such as Omaha. Those tornado warnings were issued well in advance of those tornadoes actually occurring. So the science behind forecasting tornadoes have gotten a lot better, or at least understanding and then getting those warnings out and in time for people to take action. Now, that's the thing that probably hasn't changed and maybe has even gotten a little bit more worse, is that a lot of times people don't take that message of that tornado coming their way as seriously as what they should, and probably don't prepare themselves for the onset of that tornado. And because there's nothing that we can do to mitigate the damages that results from a tornado or change its path. A tornado is a fact of nature, a creation of nature, and it's going to happen no matter what. We just need to basically help ourselves and our family members get out of the way or prepare for its onset.
How good are we at predicting its path?
Well, I think we're pretty good compared to what we were in 96, at that point in time, or even compared back, years before that. We continue to learn something new about tornadoes all the time and the path that they take. But one thing that people need to understand is that radars don't detect tornadoes. Radars detect the circulation from which the tornadoes come from. In order for us to detect a tornado, we would have to have a radar basically almost every 30 miles around the United States, and that's not going to happen, obviously. But the radars have allowed us to really pinpoint down where the circulation is and get a good approximation of where that tornado is, and then project its path out from there. And that's where we provide that information in the warnings by listing the cities that are going to be impacted by the tornado and then also giving an approximate time of when that occurrence will happen. So people need to listen to the information that's contained in that warning, because that is very valuable information that's going to help protect yourself and your family.
This is a terrible thing that I'm really bad at this. So when I ask these basic questions, I am talking really to people like me who have a tendency to just be clueless about the weather, even if I'm standing in it. So when you have that, those kinds of warnings, pay attention and take action. What do you want people to know about the kind of action they need to take during a tornado watch?
Well, the tornado watch is basically look around to your surroundings. And, you know, if you're at work, your home, at school, church, wherever it is, where would you seek shelter? Because tornadoes don't occur when it's convenient. They occur when it's inconvenient to you. So minimize that by being more prepared, by looking at your immediate surroundings and try to find out the most structurally sound location that you would go to seek refuge from that tornado. That's the main thing. When you hear the watch, that means conditions are favorable for that tornado to occur. It doesn't mean for certain that it will, but it means you need to start preparing for that at that point in time.
And then you hear a warning for your area. What do you do to take action then?
Plain and simple, take that warning seriously and get yourself and your family members to a place of safety. Avoid the urge of going out and trying to look for it. And everyone, you know, years ago when this movie came out in 96, you had to really go back in your house, so to speak, grab your camcorder, which was a weight of 20 pounds, and put that on your shoulder, and go outside and film it. Now everyone has a camera in their back pocket via their phone. And so a lot of times we're seeing more and more people, and we saw this down in Omaha recently, of people standing outside their houses and videoing recording this tornado as it's approaching. We need to avoid that. We need you to get to your place of safety as soon as possible. The best place to go would be an area below ground, such as your basement, or a room that has no windows, and just wait for the storm to pass. But that's the main thing that you need to do is, number one, believe that it's going to occur and convince yourself that you need to get to your place of safety as soon as you possibly can.
All right, a cow is not going to come flying through your window, but the flying debris that you see in these movies that people often just barely avoid because that's part of the drama. So many people get hurt because there are objects flying through the air. Say something about that so people understand, even if you don't see the twister itself, you might be injured or even killed with some flying debris in high winds.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Lori. That's the main result of all the deaths and injuries. Tornadoes don't kill people. It's the flying debris that injures and kills people. And so that's what you need to protect yourself from. That's one thing that's depicted wrongly in the movie Twister. Though, all these people are subjected to all this debris and they come out unscathed and maybe a little bit of mud on their face or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's not a real case scenario. You need to protect yourself from the debris, and that's why we tell people to seek shelter underground, in your basement, because that's going to at least provide a little bit of protection of that debris going over the top of you. And so those are the things that you need to keep in mind. Also, a lot of times they'll talk about in this movie seeking shelter underneath a bridge or an overpass. That's one of the worst things that you can do because you're going to be subjected to stronger winds and more debris. So you're exactly right. We need to protect ourselves from the debris. And a lot of times people will have bicycle helmets or football helmets, if you can imagine, in their basement or their shelter location to put over their child's head because you need to protect their head from that flying debris.
Yeah. If you are caught out in your car, what are you supposed to do if you don't go to an underpass?
Well, this is the whole thing, is that we need to be more proactive in thinking about where we're driving into. Look out ahead. We all have a phone, a smartphone. If you have someone driving with you, have them look at the radar, see what's going on. Our phones can be alerted by the warning messages that the Weather Service sends out. If you're heading into that storm, maybe you need to stop driving and move into shelter locations like a town or whatever and wait for that storm to pass. If you have no other option, and I mean no other option, there's no other farm or building that you could drive to and take shelter there, what we recommend you to do is to take shelter in a ditch, a low-lying area like a ravine, and cover your head with your hands and hope that nothing happens. But that is the ultimate last thing that you should ever do. But definitely avoid the overpass.
Yeah, you're in big trouble then if that's what happens. So
yes,
prepare,
exactly right.
pay attention. That's Todd Heidkamp, meteorologist in charge with the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls. We recorded that conversation in May. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. If you have spent quality time with a chameleon in South Dakota, it's probably been in a pet store or in a lab at the University of South Dakota. One of the researchers at the forefront of chameleon science is Christopher Anderson. He's an associate professor of biology at USD. He is also chair of the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Chameleon Specialist Group. Let's start with how this scaly reptile stole his scientific heart.
I actually really loved reptiles from a pretty young age. Some of my earliest memories were going out into mangrove forests with my dad on his shoulders when I was 3 years old and we were living in Indonesia. And from that early age, I kind of had decided I wanted to grow up and study reptiles and be a herpetologist. But when I was in middle school, I became interested in chameleons, mostly at the time because I was interested in having one as a pet. And my dad had previously had, you know, various reptiles as pets growing up and so forth, and kind of knew that chameleons had a reputation for being sensitive. And so he was a little leery of, you know, just giving me, you know, permission to get a chameleon as a pet. He wanted to make sure that I was ready for it, that I knew what I was getting into and so forth. And so he kind of gave me a challenge that if I did my research and basically read up on everything that I could find on chameleons for the next 6 months, if I was still interested, then, you know, we would talk, essentially. And I did, and it kind of snowballed from there and became a little bit of an obsession. And here we are, you know, decades later, and it's, you know, still a hobby of mine. It's now my profession as well. And so, yeah, it's kind of become all-encompassing.
When you get undergrad students in the lab, do you find some similar stories that maybe they had an early interest in something that has blossomed into something new and they finally find you?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, I get students that are really interested in reptiles and, you know, they're really excited about being able to work with chameleons. Some of my graduate students have actually come from, you know, across the country to specifically work with me because they really loved chameleons. And, you know, I'm kind of one of the main labs to study those. And so they have come from far away to be able to do that. So yeah, it's nice to be able to help students get that experience.
There are so many fascinating things about chameleons. Let's start with, however, whether that pet trade is impacting their ability to thrive in the wild or whether habitat reduction is impacting that. Tell us a little bit about how many species there are and how they're doing in the wild.
Yeah, so one of the cool things I think about chameleons is if you mention chameleons to people, generally people will have a picture in their mind of what a chameleon is, because chameleons have fascinated researchers and naturalists and the public for centuries. Mm-hmm. Some of the first work on chameleons was actually by Aristotle in, you know, like, I don't know, 200 BC or something like that. And they've really been kind of a fixture in a lot of our cultural and, you know, just general nature fascination since then. And so people generally know what chameleons are. You know, oftentimes people are leery of reptiles, particularly snakes, but, you know, chameleons seem to be one of those animals that they're like, oh, yeah, you know, I like chameleons. Chameleons are interesting. They're cool. And that's because of a lot of these unique features that they have. There's currently 228 species of chameleons that are described and recognized to science, but every year we're finding new species. And if you look at reptiles in general, about 21% of reptiles are threatened in the wild. Mm-hmm. Chameleons are actually disproportionately threatened. There's at least 34% of chameleon species that are threatened at varying levels, and that can be either critically endangered or vulnerable. And most of those are vulnerable due to habitat degradation. And in particular, there's a lot of local endemism with chameleons. And so while there are some chameleons that are very broad in their distribution, there's a couple species that live, you know, over very wide swaths of Africa and so forth, there's actually a lot of diversity that is extremely localized. And in particular, they're localized to like isolated mountain peaks where they are isolated at that location because the lower elevations, the habitat becomes inhospitable for them. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is that these many of these species don't really have a place to go if that local habitat is destroyed or impacted. And as a result of that, we have fairly high threat levels due to habitat degradation, just impacts on those local habitats. Now, chameleons are also extremely heavily traded for the pet trade. And so there's, like I said, about 228 species that are currently recognized. And there's a few of those species that are bred in captivity very successfully. And, the trade in wild-caught chameleons of those species is very minimal, if there's anything at all. There's also a number of chameleon species that have been introduced to various habitats in Florida and California and Hawaii and so forth. There's sources for some of these species that don't impact the wild populations, the native populations for many of these species. Mm-hmm. However, there's actually a lot of different species that do enter the trade through, the exports from these native countries. And much of that trade is legal. Some of it is illegal. There is some illicit trade. And many of those species can be traded sustainably. However, there are a number of those species that are traded in excess, that the trade levels are likely to be unsustainable. And so it's something that, through kind of my other hat, I'm associate professor here at the University of South Dakota. But I also am the chair of the IUCN's Chameleon Specialist Group. And the IUCN is a group that's, oftentimes recognized for their IUCN Red List of Threatened Species, which is this website and assessment process that categorizes different species for their threat levels. Many of these species are threatened. And with that position as the IUCN's Chameleon Specialist Group chair, we definitely have to monitor a lot of those trade levels just to make sure that those trade levels are not exceeding sustainable bycatch type, levels.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about some of the adaptations that we think of as lay people of being significant and that you have found worthy of study. But first, chameleons are inherently watchable. You just can't take your eyes off of them.
Yeah.
But I haven't spent a great number of time around them. Are they individual too? When you, like a dog is a different personality, do you see chameleons throughout your career doing unique things that help you understand that they are not all the same?
Absolutely. With that type of diversity, these 228 species, one of the things that I find fascinating about them is the variation that we see across those species. As I mentioned, people have an idea of what a chameleon is in their head, but one of the things that I think is particularly fascinating is just how diverse chameleons are in their own right. And so we have species that at full grown are about a centimeter and a half in body length. So we're talking about half an inch in body length and weighing about half of a gram, up to species that have body lengths of near 2 feet long. I mean, so we're talking about a huge range in body sizes. We have species that lay eggs and other species that give live birth. We have species that are living in like arboreal habitats and other species that are walking across desert sand dunes and very terrestrial. We have species that have just these incredible color displays and then other species that are much more drab in their coloration. And so there's just a really impressive variety of adaptations and behaviors that we see in chameleons. And that's really one of the things that I find the most fascinating is trying to understand what drives some of that variation and what makes some of these species different from each other.
And that makes it really applicable to all kinds of other scientific studies beyond the chameleon, right? Because
exactly.
You're learning how things adapt and change to environments. This is really impactful work from a small little reptile.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because of that diversity, we're really able to answer questions about what features of their environment are driving some of these changes and how changes to some of those environmental conditions are mitigated by these animals and how they're able to respond to them.
Mm. All right, let's talk about some of those features. The tongue and the way they feed is incredibly fascinating to watch. You've got some slow motion video on your website.
Mm-hmm. So the ballistic tongue projection is what we call it, is one of the main features of the research in my lab. And so chameleons are able to project their tongues out of their mouth at explosive performance to be able to capture prey items some distance away from them. And previous research had really focused on larger chameleon species because they were easy to work with, more available to researchers and so forth. And what they were finding is that chameleons were projecting their tongues out about 1 to 2 times of their body length, which is pretty incredible. And they do it quite quickly. It's about 5.5 meters per second, and with really high accelerations and power outputs or energy release rates. And, it's always been known to be this really impressive behavior and feature. But it turns out some previous work in my lab, we looked at some of the smaller species, and it turns out that those smaller species actually produce more explosive performance than those larger species. And so we had actually, in the literature, had kind of a sampling bias where we were under estimating the performance capacity of these animals by focusing on these larger species. And it turns out that small chameleon species can project their tongues 2.5 times their body length. And they do so at accelerations that are about 250 times the acceleration due to gravity. And so 250 Gs. And if you think about like the space shuttle on launch and reentry, that was experiencing about 3 Gs. And so we're talking about incredible accelerations and the power outputs, which is this rate of energy release. Muscle is only physiologically capable of releasing energy up to a certain level, and that's about 1,000 watts per kilogram. Chameleons are able to do 14 times that. They're able to produce 14,000 watts of watts per kilogram of muscle mass, which is just insane.
How?
Yeah, and that's the question is, how do they do
how?
That?
How, and can we replicate it in the ways that are useful to humans?
Yeah. Exactly, and we actually do. It's called a power amplification mechanism, and it's basically incorporating a spring into movements. And so what happens is you're able to decouple the action of the muscle from the actual movement itself. And that's because the muscle is going to first stretch that spring or those elastic tissues, and then it's going to be the recoil of those elastic tissues or that spring that's going to then power the movement. And that spring mechanically is able to release energy more quickly than muscle is able to produce it. And so chameleons incorporate one of these elastic recoil powered mechanisms a little bit like a bow and arrow, where they first kind of stretch those elastic tissues before the tongue is launched, and then the tongue is launched because of the recoil of those elastic tissues, which happens after the muscle is already contracted.
So if you're just taking a walk, let's say somewhere in the field, and you're thinking about the chameleon, what are you wondering that you wish you knew, and how are you planning a study that will help you answer a research question in a lab? Take me inside your mind of a scientist to help me understand how that's working in your brain.
So there's a lot about chameleons that I wish we knew. That elastic recoil powered mechanism, we kind of fundamentally understand that it's there. We have isolated some of these elastic tissues, and we have some hypotheses about how that stretch is occurring and how that recoil is being, that energy from that recoil is being imparted into the tongue to project it. But it's not very clear the exact mechanism for how that's really working. And so I would love to be able to have a more in-depth picture of what that does. Mm-hmm. One of the cool things, or one of the cool side effects of this elastic recoil powered mechanism, however, is that it also liberates chameleons from a lot of the effect of temperature that they would otherwise experience as a reptile. So reptiles are ectotherms. They need to obtain their body temperature, or their body temperature is affected by the environment around them. They're not able to produce their own metabolic heat. And the result of that is on cold mornings, you oftentimes will see reptiles out basking to elevate their body temperature so that they can then move more quickly. And that's because all of those enzymatic reactions that are occurring that power that movement are temperature dependent. And with a tongue projection mechanism, that muscle contraction that stretches those elastic tissues, that's strongly affected by temperature, just like what we would expect. Mm-hmm. But just because it happens more slowly, it's still able to stretch those elastic tissues to the same degree as it would at higher temperatures. But the recoil of those elastic tissues is temperature insensitive. And what that means is that the tongue projection in chameleons is weakly affected by temperature. And at cold body temperatures, so first thing in the morning, when other lizard species are physiologically unable to capture food, chameleons can launch their tongue from their mouth, capture food, bring that prey item back into their mouth, chew it up, and then just wait for the body temperatures to increase as the day goes on to be able to digest them. And so I find that that's really fascinating. And one of the things that I'm interested in is how thermal adaptation happens. And so how different species that are living in different thermal environments are able to adjust their physiology to be able to perform in the environment that they are experiencing. Huh. And that's really important as some of the temperatures in different habitats become more variable or start shifting, to be able to understand how these animals are going to be able to adapt to them, at what functional level that adaptation is occurring. Because when we look at movement, like our own walking, we see kind of this smooth behavior that's occurring, but underlying that behavior is muscle physiology, there's neuromotor control, there's anatomical features that all are working together to produce that seamless motion. And we don't really know at what level functionally that thermal adaptation is occurring. And so that's one of the things actually we're studying in my lab, is I have a grant right now where we're going to South Africa and working with species that live in very different environments to start looking at how temperature affects those different underlying processes that are responsible for producing that kind of seamless motion that we see in that explosive performance, both the tongue projection and then the tongue retraction as well.
Wow. The early chameleon gets the cricket?
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it makes sense. We think of chameleons as these ambush predators. Mm-hmm. And as an ambush predator, you would need to be able to take advantage of feeding opportunities whenever you have them. And so if you can take advantage of a feeding opportunity first thing in the morning when other lizards are not able to capture their food, that's beneficial for the animal, for the chameleon. And so that's, kind of a nice byproduct of this explosive performance that they're using or achieving with that elastic recoil mechanism.
Let's talk a little bit about the camouflage ability of the chameleon. We even call people a chameleon if they change their personalities to adapt to certain social situations. And it can be a compliment. It can be an insult. The cartoons of chameleons are very brightly color shifting in plaids and polka dots and rainbows. How many chameleons use some kind of changing mechanism to hide from predators?
Well, all chameleon species are able to change color to certain degrees. And so all chameleons are able to, change some of their body colors based on various factors. And they will change their color for different reasons. Some of that is going to be thermoregulatory. And so they're going to be able to produce slightly darker coloration if they want to warm up. They become more pale if they are warm and want to be able to cool down, which makes sense. A lot of our cultural application of chameleon color change, as you said, is this blending in to the background, however. And it turns out that that's a little bit of an old wives' tale with chameleons. You know, there's a lot of these cartoons and these, manipulated TikTok videos and so forth of chameleons that are, stepping onto different colored objects, or you change the background that a chameleon's on and the chameleon changes that to that color. And kind of the classic example is putting a chameleon on like a plaid surface, and the chameleon will adopt that color. And that's actually not how it works. Chameleons actually don't just adopt the color and background match to anything that they are on. Chameleons are much more limited than the extent to which that they can change color, based largely on what their typical environment is and what, natural selection over time has favored as far as the ability of different animals to change color. And they will do some background matching in the sense that, if they see a bird predator, birds generally come to prey on chameleons from above, and so they will actually become darker to be able to background match a little bit against the ground. Whereas if it's a snake that's coming towards them, there's been experiments that have shown that they tend to become pale and lighter because a snake is going to tend to come from below, and then they're background matching better against a light sky. And so they do some background matching, but they generally aren't just changing color to the background or the object that they are on like we usually think. And a lot of that is stemming from the fact that most chameleon color change is actual responses to interactions with other individuals or other species. And so a lot of it is social cues. And when a chameleon is stressed or it's nervous, it becomes dark. And so much of this is based on the fact that when you see a chameleon in a tree, it's happy, it's green, it's bright and vibrant, and then people would grab it and they'd put it on a stick and bring it out, and all of a sudden it would get dark and it would start transitioning to a similar color to the branch that it was on. And so this kind of bred this idea of they're matching their background. But really what's happening is that chameleon's frightened, it's scared, it's stressed, and so it's becoming dark and kind of muted coloration. And we're just misinterpreting what's going on. But most chameleon color change is actually communication between other individuals of their species. And so they can communicate things about, aggression or submission with, male-male interactions or male-female interactions. They can signal things with their color change about, intentions, whether they're it's a courtship display or from like a male that's trying to, court a female, or it can be a female that's communicating to a male that she's pregnant and is not receptive to breeding and so forth. And that's where we actually see most of the color change in chameleons. Mm-hmm. And so it's just one of those situations where we've kind of made some observations and misinterpreted them a little bit, but it's taken off into a form of its own as far as our own cultural folklore goes.
Not to stretch this point too far, but I'm curious your thoughts as a scientist, because I see humans inspired linguistically, inspired artistically, inspired poetically by this species. Do you think we can also be inspired in a way that helps us protect habitat, address climate change, and is caring about the chameleon in this way, similar to what I think happened with the octopus after Cy Montgomery's books, really talking about all these different sort of octopus personalities in a film about My Octopus Teacher? And it seems like we get attached to certain creatures that somehow we see something in. Does that inspire us to take care of our natural world?
I think so.
I think that's
really a strong point there. We really are only going to be pushed or encouraged to conserve things that we know and that we appreciate. And charismatic animals, charismatic megafauna and so forth tend to become poster childs for conservation efforts or efforts to preserve habitats and so forth that those species live in. And I think chameleons are a great example of one of these charismatic reptiles that a lot of people can appreciate, even if, maybe reptiles aren't necessarily their favorite organism. Chameleons just have a way about them that they're fairly innocuous. They are interesting, they're intriguing, and their behaviors are so extreme that, people can really latch on to them and, let that fascination take hold in a way that can be beneficial for, education and awareness about what's going on with some of the habitats in the wild and hopefully then preserve some of the habitat these animals live in and the other species that live with them as well.
Yeah, you mentioned live births for some chameleons. I want to know, how tiny? Say more about that, please.
Yeah, so of course there's a huge variation in body sizes, like I mentioned.
Yeah.
And some of the species are incredibly small. These species that give live birth tend to be on the smaller end of the spectrum for chameleons, and the babies can be very small. And so I have some photographs that I've taken of newborn baby live birth chameleons. And I have them kind of gripping on a penny, and they are basically the size of the head on of the president on the penny. And it's, you know, just super impressive. And at that body size, they're still able to project their tongues. They're still able to change color.
Wow.
They're able to do all of these things, and it's super remarkable.
All right, you're on your way to South Africa. We'll close with a little bit about what you're hoping to see and do and learn in that trip and how you will bring it back to the lab.
Yeah, and so for my lab right now, we have a grant that's sending us to do field work in South Africa for about 5 years. And we're sampling different species from different habitats, and we're looking at their feeding performance at different body temperatures. And so we're using high-speed video to film their feeding at about 3,000 frames per second so that we can slow down the motions and then be able to characterize the performance. And we're doing that across a range of body temperatures from about 15 degrees Celsius to 35 degrees Celsius. And so we're trying to tease apart how species that live in different thermal environments are able to respond to temperature change, you know, how some species may be better adapted to respond to temperature change than other species, how acclimation effects might help an animal cope over, you know, shorter periods of time and so forth. And so, yeah, when we go, we are traveling to different areas and collecting different species from those different habitats to film them in the lab.
Christopher Anderson is Associate Professor of Biology at the University of South Dakota. We spoke with him in May. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Once a tiny deer roamed the prehistoric Great Plains. And when I say tiny, I mean like the size of a cat. When the deer died, it became part of an abundant fossil record. About 32 million years later, that fossil was discovered in what we now call Badlands National Park by a park intern. Park rangers Madison Schriro and Ed Welch studied the find and published research proposing that the deer belongs in a new genus. Here is Ranger Madison Schriro explaining the tiny deer and its big implications for the scientific record.
One of our geoscientists in the park's interns here at Badlands was out exploring in the park on her first day, of course, because that's how it always goes. Somebody finds something really cool and amazing on their very first day. And she found this cute little teeny tiny skull that can fit in the palm of your hand. And she did the exact right thing. She left it where it was, took photos, got coordinates, and reported it to the rangers, who passed that on to the paleontologists. Then that specimen was excavated by our paleontologists here at the park and then taken back to our fossil preparation lab on site in the Ben Riffel Visitor Center and beautifully prepared by one of our paleontologists there. And as she began to carefully remove the rock and the sediment from the skull, we began to realize that this thing really doesn't match up to the skulls of the other types of ancient deer we have seen before here at Badlands. So that's what kind of led us into the idea to research this in the first place.
And then you think, this is exciting, and oh no, there is a lot of work ahead of me.
Yeah, exactly.
So first of all, Tiffany, who is the intern who discovers this, like, what does she, it's never going to get better than that, maybe. Like, that's how many.
Yeah, right, like, first day.
You can go
finding
home
something
now.
Amazing.
Yeah. All right, so what are some of the ways that you knew it was special? How was it different from what was already on record?
Yeah, so we looked at this skull, and the teeth told us that it was it belonged to this species called Leptomeryx ellisae, and that was defined back in 2002. But previously, that species was only known from lower jaws, lower teeth. Nobody had ever seen a skull before. So we're sitting there thinking, oh, great, we've got the first skull. Let's write this thing up. Let's describe it. Let's get it into the written record so people have access to it and can research it further if they so choose. And that's when things started to get complicated, of course, because the original idea was that we would either synonymize this species with another one that already exists. We say, oh, the differences in the teeth are actually individual variation and not indicative of, you know, a whole new species because the skulls are the same. Or we'd take a look at the skull and be like, that's totally different. So we are going to verify that it is its own species. But what we didn't expect was that the skull would be so different that we would have to make it its own new genus. Basically, what happened was the teeth look very similar to a genus of deer that we do see in the fossil record at Badlands called Leptomerix. But the skull, the anatomy of the skull aligned perfectly, not perfectly, but very close to this genus that comes 10 million years later in the Miocene period called Pseudoparablastomerix, which is a mouthful of a name. So our guy had this suite of like kind of intermediate characters, teeth from one genus, a skull that looks like another. So since it aligned with nothing, we had to make it its own new genus.
So then that brings the question, you're not going to find hundreds of these skulls around the Badlands, or is it a evolutionary bridge between one and the other? Like, what are some of the questions that you have now that you know the things that you do know?
Yeah, I think kind of the most important question we ended up with after we kind of concluded this paper and published it was that there are a lot of other species of these tiny deer that have been described in the past from only the teeth. We find their teeth quite commonly, actually. We just don't see the skulls for whatever reason. And so now we're kind of like reevaluating all of them and searching across different paleontological collections, looking for other skulls to add to our data set. Because we are realizing that when you define things based on just the teeth with these little deer, it's not necessarily going to tell you the whole story. Yeah. Our Leptomerix ellisae example that used to be defined from just the teeth, it does, if you look at just the teeth, it does belong to that genus Leptomerix. But once we found the skull and it looks like this totally different genus from 10 million years later, we begin to realize, you know, that's not the case. So we're realizing that the using just characters from the teeth is kind of a flawed practice. So we're hoping to be able to find more skulls in the field or in collections that haven't been described yet and kind of add to our knowledge.
Tell us about the name, because this is one of the exciting parts of making a discovery, is that you get to help figure out how we're all going to refer to it, how scientists are going to refer to it in the future.
Yeah, so we brainstormed a while for that perfect name, you know, because it's not every day that you get to name something. So we were, of course, super excited about that. And we eventually landed on the name Santusimerix, which means Santusi's ruminant. And we named it in honor of our good friend and colleague, Vincent Santusi, who is the senior paleontologist for the National Park Service. He actually got his start in the Park Service here at Badlands, and his master's thesis research is on the same area of the park that this tiny deer came from. So we thought this was like the best way we could think of to honor him. He's always been a huge supporter of the paleontology program here at Badlands and also for the Park Service in general. So we just wanted to give him a huge shout out from a park that he feels, you know, very connected to.
Yeah. All right. So you said ruminant, and that makes me want to ask you about how this deer would have lived. What was its environment like? How did it eat? Did it travel in herds? Like, what do we know and what do we not know about what its life would have been like?
That's a great question. So 32 million years ago here at Badlands and in this area, we know that we would have been in kind of what they would call a distal floodplain setting, where there are these, you know, braided river channels kind of meandering. It's kind of transitioning from more of a woodland into more of an open woodland or scrubland, working our way towards evolving the grasslands ecosystem for the first time. So there's a good amount of plants and trees, but not too densely packed. And this little teeny tiny deer is probably roaming around. We aren't, you know, too sure about any terms of behavior in terms of like whether they were parts of herds or roamed more individually. Deer today, of course, you see them usually in herds, but our little deer is probably most closely related to the living group called the chevrotains, and those are in Southeast Asia exclusively, I believe. And they have, you know, I think they tend to roam individually more often than in herds. So tough to, you know, make any sort of determinations on behavior for this guy beyond the fact that we do know that it was a herbivore, yeah. So eating mostly plants out here. When an area is good at producing fossils, such as the Badlands, you're usually either good at pre- pre- preserving animal fossils or plant fossils, not usually both. So we mostly have animal fossils here at Badlands, but we do have some plants material, mostly in the form of hackberry seeds, teeny tiny fossilized seeds. So we have some leafy plants that these guys could have been eating, stuff like that, as well as some grasses.
Help us understand how you had to present your research, because it's not just what you think, it's what you can prove. You have to document evidence. You have to present it to other scientists for publication. Tell us a little bit about that process for you and Ed.
Absolutely. So we went to different paleontology collections, and we measured a bunch of teeny tiny teeth and as many of these little skulls as we could find to compile a convincing data set. That was kind of the first step. And then we started writing down our findings, you know, creating essentially a case for why this should be its own genus, because it doesn't fit with anything else. And then we started writing the paper. And at the same time, we submitted an abstract, which is just like a short, 300 words or less summary of your research. We submitted an abstract to a national geology conference, and it was accepted for a presentation. So we actually got to travel to Pittsburgh to present at the Geologic Society of America conference, which was a great way to get the research out there before it had been published and get some feedback from our peers. And then we finished writing the rest of the paper, presented it actually a couple more times at a few other conferences, including the South Dakota Academy of Science conference, which the South Dakota Academy of Science is the journal that we ended up publishing in. And then finished writing up that paper, made some figures, and then went into the peer review process. So other scientists, other paleontologists read through our paper, gave us feedback, and we incorporated that and then submitted it to the journal to get it out there.
And you're that kid who was walking around in elementary school saying, I want to be a paleontologist someday. And if you could go back and talk to that kid now, what would you tell her about her future in science?
She would be so excited. I've literally, since I could like walk, I was telling people that I wanted to be a geologist and a paleontologist when I grew up. I went to school for geology, so I felt like I had accomplished that one. But publishing this paleontology paper was huge for me. It was such a huge accomplishment because it made that, you know, little inner child in me like just freak out. Yeah. Like, I did it.
Okay,
so it's not dinosaurs. Is really exciting to me as well.
Yeah. Okay. So I can imagine you like sketching this little deer in your, you know, three ring binder, loose leaf paper notebook or whatever. What would you have named it back then?
Oh my gosh. Back then I wouldn't come up with such a fancy name. Oh man. I would have named it something really weird probably.
let's wrap up with this idea of like back in the beginning, we said, Tiffany, is it Leone? I don't know how to pronounce Tiffany's last name.
Leone.
Did the responsible reporting. So for all the citizen scientists who are looking and keeping their eyes open as they travel the Badlands this summer, let's leave them with some tips on if you find something really cool, what is the thing that you have to do to make sure this kind of science can be done for the scientific record and you're not damaging, destroying, or taking, God forbid, the things that you find? What would you leave us with?
Yeah, thank you so much for circling back to that. We always try to emphasize that here at Badlands because you never know how much just one fossil can tell you. I mean, this one fossil turned into a whole paper. So what you should do when you're out here in Badlands, we actually have an open hike policy, which means you're allowed to hike off trail here as long as, you know, you keep your own safety in mind and you can make sure to get back to your vehicle. We don't want to come rescue you or anything. Yeah. But if you're out there exploring on or off trail and you see something that you think might be a fossil, no matter how big or small, go ahead and leave it exactly where it is. Take photos. If you include an object for scale in the photo, any common object like a pencil, a water bottle, a coin, something like that, that's super helpful. And then if you take photos of the surrounding landscape to show our paleontologists what the area looks like, that's helpful as well. And then getting GPS coordinates for your find. You can either do that by kind of dropping a pin on a map on a smartphone, or I like to just pull up my Compass app and take a screenshot. So it's all in my camera roll, one right after another.
All right.
And then you can come down to either of our visitor centers and report that find in person, or you can email those finds to badlands_fossil_finds@nps.gov.
That's our conversation from May with our fossil friend, Ranger Madison Schriro. She's a geologist and paleontologist at Badlands National Park. That is our South Dakota Science Roundup for today. We hope that it served you. You can find all our science, technology, and innovation stories on our website, sdpb.org. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.